Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFAG. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte School of Law closed its doors last year after losing accreditation and leaving many students with no degrees, few options for finishing their education elsewhere, and a mountain of debt. The Art Institute of Charlotte has also announced it is closing. Both these schools are for-profit institutions, and they joined the ranks of other for-profit colleges in closing their doors. Now, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is pushing for rules that would change how these schools are regulated, including a rule that critics claim would make it more difficult for students who claim they were defrauded to seek debt relief. Only about 5% of North Carolina students attend these types of schools, and many are unaware they are enrolled in for-profit institutions. If the schools made good on the promise of higher education, their status as for-profit institutions probably wouldn't matter. But given the problems that are suddenly surfacing at many of these institutions, that appears to be an open question. So we're going to explore this avenue of higher education for the rest of the hour with Dr. Tressie McMillan Cottom, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University and author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy, which I'm told has been making waves in the for-profit industry. She joins us via Skype. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Gunderson is president and CEO of the Association of Career Education Colleges and Universities. That's a trade group representing the for-profit college sector, and he is with us by phone. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
And Eric Kelderman is senior staff reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He is also with us by phone. Thanks for being here, Eric. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So, Doctor, let me begin with you. For-profit colleges are the fastest growing sector of higher education, if I'm not mistaken by that. Why is that? What's driving this trend?
Well, there are a few things, and the extent to be fair, you know, higher education is not looking at sort of limitless growth, but of the growth that is happening in the higher education sector, we had about 20 years where most of that growth was happening in the for-profit college sector. There has been some leveling off here over the last 5 years, I think mostly related to cycles in the labor market. But the reason why people pursue, that was actually my question. Why do we see so many people pursuing what those of us in traditional higher education had historically thought of as a very narrow slice of higher education opportunity for most people? Why were we suddenly seeing this sort of explosive growth, especially among students that we did not think of as being the typical for-profit college student? So there are a couple of reasons for that. The number one reason that you find when you talk to students, and I talk to many of them in addition to visiting schools, and that is in addition to working in them previously in my previous life, is that more people are being similarly impacted by changes in our labor market. And those changes will sound familiar to everyone listening to you. That sounds like increasing demands for us to stay sort of job ready in a labor market that does not or does not provide us opportunity to do so without returning to school. That looks like needing to stay job ready and pursue additional higher education without leaving the labor market. So people need to work and go to school, right? And traditional higher education had been perceived, certainly, there's, I think, some disagreement about to the extent to which that is true. But it is true that people perceive that it is more difficult to attend traditional higher education than it is to attend, for example, online or to do evening and weekend sort of course schedules, of which are the specialty of the for-profit college sector. But all of that is wrapped up in the fact that what we have not provided for in our social safety net is a way for people to pursue sort of dignified, high-quality work in a changing economy without the individual bearing all of the risk of returning to higher education.
So let me bring Steve Gunderson into this conversation. He's the president and CEO of the Association of Career Education Colleges and Universities. These for-profit colleges that we're talking about pretty much are also referred to as workforce education programs. they seem to overlap with a lot of what community colleges do. For instance, in Charlotte, Central Piedmont Community College does a lot of workforce education. They pride themselves on essentially being a training force, college for certain businesses and industries. How do these for-profit institutions differ? Why would a student choose to pay all this tuition and incur this debt when they could just go to a community college?
Okay. Good question, but let me first correct something that it's really important for this conversation. Since 2010, over 2,000 campuses in our sector have closed, and our enrollment is actually down 1.6 million annually. So the growth in this sector occurred right up to and during the recession. Mm-hmm. And when people lost their jobs, they felt they needed some kind of a career skill, and most of them went to our schools because our schools tend to provide accelerated, focused academic programming related to a specific career. The second thing that's happening is that outcomes do matter. And when you compare our two-year programs with two-year publics, we have about twice as many graduate completions as the two-year publics do. So you have a better outcome there because there's smaller classes, there's more mentoring, it's more of an academic focus, etc. The other thing, and I'm a fan of community colleges, but what's happening, Mike, is that more and more community colleges are becoming junior liberal arts feeder systems, and they're doing the liberal arts programming for students who will then go to a state college or university to get their other 2 years and get their Bachelor of Arts degree in a liberal arts program. There's nothing wrong with that, but as that happens, our sector is more and more responding to what you and I would call cutting-edge academic programming related to specific careers.
So explain this to me, because last night I was watching television after having prepared for this conversation, and there was Queen Latifah on my TV screen doing a commercial, I think it was for Strayer University, saying that she was the first person in her family who had ever gone to college and she'd never finished her degree, and that's the one thing that she regrets in her life. But you can do it. You can go. Let's do this, she kept saying. Let's do this. In other words, enroll in Strayer and become a college graduate. She's approaching this as though it were a four-year degree. Is that false Strayer, advertising, or is that particular to Strayer?
And Queen Latifah's
Hold it. That's for Steve.
Yeah.
Okay. Strayer is one of the four-year programs. The bulk of the schools, and there are about 2,700 for-profit schools in the country right now, and about 2,200 of those schools are two-year or less. But there's about 300-400 of those schools that offer 4 years, some even offer graduate programs.
Okay. Eric, I mentioned earlier in this conversation that a lot of people who go to these for-profit schools don't know that they're for-profit schools. First of all, why are students unaware of this, and why would it matter whether they're for-profit or not for-profit? If you have to pay tuition to go to a school, what difference does it make?
I think I'm not exactly sure why students don't know that they're for-profit. There's no, I guess, requirement that students be told that they're going to a for-profit institution as opposed to, say, a traditional nonprofit or private nonprofit institution. The sector's run into a lot of problems because of the regulatory environment. And I think, we do need to stress that it is actually quite diverse. There are four-year institutions. There are a number of small privately owned institutions that range, across the spectrum of enrollment. So, what they are supposed to be told, though, is, there are requirements under the federal law that they be told, the placement outcomes for their jobs, what they might expect to earn, things like that. And there are big questions about, I think, some of the problems that many of these schools have run into is by not disclosing many of the important details, or in the case of, for instance, Corinthian and ITT, big for-profit chains that were closed in 2016, that they were disclosing inaccurate information. And that was a big problem also at Charlotte Law, whether students were being told accurately how many of them would land up in gainful jobs after they graduated.
Yeah, Steve, come on. I know I'm losing Steve Gunderson at 9:40, so I'm going to cram some questions in here for you, Steve, before I lose you.
Okay.
These schools are accredited in the same way as other institutions of higher learning, are they not?
Yes, correct.
So if they are living up, if they're living up to their accreditation, why are graduation rates so low? Because I think graduation rates are like at 23%, for instance, at Kaplan University.
Well, okay, it's a really good question, Mike, and let's separate online liberal arts education for part-time school students versus the foundation of our sector, which is on-site delivery of career-oriented programs. If you will, as I said earlier, if you look at our two-year schools and compare them to the two-year publics, which is for the most part community colleges, our graduation rate is twice as high. If you look at the four-year numbers and you look at open enrollment public institutions and compare them with ours, we, again, do just as good, if not better, than the four-year open enrollments. We don't do as good as the Princetons and Harvards of the world for obvious reasons. But we've heard the call about outcomes, and I think if you will look at current data, not data from a decade ago, but current data, we can stand up against any sector of higher education in our completion rates, graduation rates. We're better than most other sectors.
When it came to Charlotte School of Law, and this is particular to Charlotte, but it may have implications elsewhere in the country for for-profit colleges, one of the problems that was revealed was that they were recruiting students who they knew or they had a strong feeling were not prepared academically to go on to law school, but they took them anyway. How much of that has to do with the fact that they're out to make a profit? And if you bring in more students, whether they graduate or not, their tuition is paying the freight.
I will not defend any school that enrolls students who are not academically and otherwise capable of completing their programs. And I think it's important to note that schools like the Charlotte School of Law were never a member of the National Association. I mean, we tend to have schools that have much higher standards than some other schools, and we get blamed for those, just like other sectors get blamed for the bad schools in their sector.
So, Doctor, do you think because Charlotte, as you say, is a hotbed for these for-profit schools, that those of us in Charlotte who have experienced the collapse of Charlotte School of Law and the closure of the Art Institute of Charlotte and King's College and several other for-profit college institutions, that our view of these schools is skewed in some way to the negative side that's not accurate or fair?
No, I wouldn't say it was skewed. I do think that Charlotte, because of its size, because of the composition of the people who live there, and because of its local labor market, the strength of its local labor market, we had more than our perhaps fair share of for-profit college institutions. But that's because we had sort of a pretty, you know, broad and diverse set of higher education institutions in the area. So I don't think that we are biased in that we are more likely to have a negative experience of for-profit colleges. It is just that we are more likely to have any experience of a for-profit college because we have so many of them in the area, if that makes sense. So historically in Charlotte, it was quite possible for a smaller local for-profit college, for example, King's College did much better than sort of the national brands in that market for a very long time because people had had historically a positive relationship with them. The local labor market, business owners had a relationship with them, and students had as well. What we're seeing, though, is that even when schools have a positive relationship with the labor market, they can't necessarily, however, outstrip some of the larger patterns of debt cycles and unemployment and underemployment that is typical for for-profit college students, even if they graduate. So now here's the thing. Going to school is only one part of the equation of how higher education increases access in our country. It has never just been about increasing access to college so that everybody can go to college. The point has been for everybody who is able and willing to go to college because of all the other rewards that are attached to it. Higher pay, greater promotability at work, better health outcomes, right? More intergenerational wealth transfer so that you can do things for your children. So when we look at sort of those larger set of issues, whether or not students graduate is certainly part of the question. But the bigger question is, when they graduate, do they have similar outcomes as students that have attended different kinds of institutions? And for various reasons attached to the school's responsibility, but also to our greater responsibility as a society, that does not seem to be universally true for all students at all institutions. And I think what we see in Charlotte is sort of just the long tail of the effect of people having cycling through some negative experiences and outcomes related to their college attendance.
The Trump administration, Steve Gunderson, the Trump administration is slightly friendlier to your industry than perhaps the Obama administration was. And they're talking about rolling back the gainful employment rule. The gainful employment rule is an initiative of the Obama administration, which said what?
Well, the gainful employment rule by the Obama administration was just a declaration of a war against our sector, and they publicly said their goal was to reduce our sector by 24% nationally. So there was a motive there that didn't relate necessarily to the word gainful employment, but they found those two words in Section 102 of the statutes, which allowed them to create a whole new definition of gainful employment, which wasn't anything about gainful employment. It was about your debt to earnings in year three of working.
Well, and Eric, you're the reporter here. How would you describe that rule?
Sure. So the rule, broadly speaking, was meant to ensure that students earned enough after they got their degree to pay back their debts. That's sort of a very broad explanation. There was a lot of controversy about the rule. It was challenged in law, and the Obama administration had to go back and rewrite it after a court ruling. The final rule was enacted, and of course the department under Secretary DeVos is now re-regulating that rule.
Are they trying to eliminate it or modify it?
The New York Times has reported that that they are generally going to the intention may be just simply to scrap it entirely, to make it give it no teeth, and maybe provide only disclosures about student outcomes rather than providing any sort of penalty.
So I have to let Steve go in 1 minute. Is that a good idea for your industry to not have that rule in place? I mean, it seems to me that would be to your advantage to be able to prove to prospective students that you're going to spend a lot of money going here, but when you get out, you're going to make a lot of money to pay this back and then some.
Actually, it's a great question, Mike, and if the rule comes out as the rumor suggested, well, this might be the biggest consumer protection for all students in all schools across this country, because what it is saying is this isn't just a rule for one sector of higher ed. It is saying that any programs funded by students using Title IV at any college or university in this country, those students will be given the data on the graduation rates, on the salaries earned by those students, the debt, all of those kind of issues. And so that there will be protection of every student at every institution in terms of the information.
So Steve Gunderson is president of the and CEO of the Association of Career Education Colleges and Universities. He has to leave us. We'll come back with more, however, with our other two guests in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. How was Lake Norman formed, and what was lost or displaced? What's up with those cell phone towers that look like trees? And how is the B-Cycle program doing with all the new dockless bike companies? Vote for the question you'd like WFAE to answer in the next episode of the FAQ City podcast by going to WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about for-profit universities for the remainder of the hour with Dr. Tressie McMillan-Cottom, Assistant Professor or Associate Professor of Sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University and the author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy, and Eric Kelderman, Senior Staff Reporter for the Chronicle for Higher Education. This book that you have written, Doctor, has made some waves in the for-profit school industry because it's pretty critical of for-profit colleges, and it's interesting because, for many reasons, but one of those reasons is that you once were a recruiter at two different for-profit colleges. And this new book, you've written and also appeared on national talk shows to spread the word about what you see as the pitfalls and the real costs of this growing trend. When did you change your point of view?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because I'm not sure that my point of view changed so much as, you know, I constantly sort of took in information as time went on. But, you know, you at the top of the hour, you talked about how many students don't know that they are attending for-profit colleges. I talk a little bit about that in the book and say that, you know, lots of us who were working in for-profit colleges also did not know that we were working in a for-profit college. That just is not, that language was just not like a meaningful designation for many of us who were working in the sector.
And let me ask you the question, does it matter? I mean, if you're going to get, if the school is a good school, and you're getting the education that you are seeking and that you're paying for, does it matter?
I think it matters if it matters to others, right? So does it matter that you decide to go to ITT Tech down the street as opposed to Central Piedmont Community College? Should it matter to you is a different question. It may not. It may be that, you know, then ITT Tech you know, was offering you something that you personally wanted. But again, one of the things that we use education for is in exchange for other things in our life, right? So you want to use that degree or that credential to then go out into the world and exchange it for a job, exchange it for certain kinds of access and certain kinds of social benefits. And so if it matters to others that you have attended a for-profit college, then what we would say sociologically is that, yes, it matters. And so that's about the perception of your degree. And perception does matter. It's one of those things that gets lost in our sort of obsessive focus on things like providing all students with a worksheet that tells them what the debt-to-income ratio is and what their tuition costs would be. While those things matter, they are not all that matter about higher education.
So, Eric, is there a bias out there among employers against students who have chosen to go to a for-profit college as opposed to a community college or something like that? Is it, and if there is that bias, is it really any different than what we know to exist between among people who have gone to an Ivy League school? They seem to get the better jobs as opposed to a state school. Is there any difference?
Well, you know, broadly speaking, I'm not sure if it matters. The for-profit degree matters. I know a lot of for-profit colleges have run into trouble because the programs that they advertise as being appropriate for the career that people are going into don't necessarily meet the licensing requirements of those fields, and that's been a big problem. So again, you know, students aren't always informed and don't always know the questions to ask. In terms of bias in the workplace overall, I mean, look, the students that go to Princeton and other Ivy League colleges already have enormous advantages that would allow them to succeed, yeah, to get into and succeed in the workplace that are sort of, you know, baked into our everyday lives.
But not all of them. Those Ivy League schools do take people who don't come from wealthy families.
Oh, a very, very, very tiny percentage. Okay. I mean, it's not even close to proportional to the number of students that low-income students across the country. I mean, I think the Ivy League, it's far less than 1% of their students are eligible for Pell Grants, and it's nationally it's more like 25 or 30% of the student population. So, yeah, there are a few students that get in there, sure, but the odds are very, very high. I mean, we talk about students from the most academically prepared students from the bottom income quartile, you know, have a very small chance of graduating from college, even though they're better prepared than students from the top income quartile. So, you know, the biases are throughout the system in a number of different ways.
So, Doctor, we'll get back to the fact that you were a recruiter at two of these schools prior to moving into other areas of higher education and writing this book. You say that these schools, and I'm assuming that you're not talking about all of them. Maybe you are. That these schools target and thrive off of inequality. How so?
Well, I think to Eric's point that lower ed is part of higher ed, right? In fact, We have institutions like for-profit colleges precisely because of certain gaps that exist in higher education overall. But then there's also sort of all the stuff that gets wrapped around higher education. And at each of those levels, there's a lot of inequality happening that produces a group of people who are particularly sensitive to the claims that for-profit colleges make. And those claims include things like, you've seen the ads, right? There's the ad of the mom with the two kids who is working at the job where she's afraid she's about to be laid off. And so she's going to do her homework in bed while her children sleep beside her, right? Mm-hmm. What is it about being a working mom then that makes them, that would make mothers so vulnerable to the promise of a accessible sort of fast education? Well, that's not just about the fact that she wants to go to school online. And in fact, when I talk to students, many of them enrolled in for-profit colleges didn't necessarily want to have to go to college, right? They're attending college because that is the only option left to them at that point in their lives for them to succeed in the labor market. And so what we know about women, of which, by the way, almost a full 3/4 of all for-profit college students are women. So whenever you hear stories about something like, you know, a for-profit college closing, especially something like King's College, a two-year school, you should be thinking of it as a problem that disproportionately impacts women. It's because women are still responsible for the majority of child care.
But are the promises made by these schools that then cause women and others to enroll because they want a better life for themselves and their family, are the promises hollow? Or do some people succeed because they've gone to these schools and graduated successfully?
You know what? And some people beat the house in Vegas. Somebody can always win in a game.
So you're saying that the deck is stacked against us, that the failure rate is going to be predominant over the success rate?
Yes.
Wow. Dr. Cottom says, Eric, that society at large trusts that education will have a positive effect on our lives and our society. But she adds that for-profits have perverted that faith, and that there's a difference between good education and bad education, and that isn't often spoken about. Is that something that's discussed among institutions of higher education? Are you hearing that spoken about these colleges as you report for the Chronicle of Higher Education?
Certainly in traditional higher ed, there's a lot of skepticism, often disdain for the for-profit sector. And let me add, I mean, you know, when we focus on these institutions, sometimes we think about these large publicly traded chains, right, like DeVry or Corinthian or ITT, right? But it really does span the range of you know, sort of what we think of as mom and pop beauty schools, right? The schools that train sort of legal assistants, things like that. So up through these. You know, these mega chains that have five and occasionally six-figure enrollments. But I think higher ed is aware of a growing skepticism in general of its role, not just in the for-profit sector. I mean, a lot of polls recently have found that the public questions the value of four-year
right.
degree, questions whether the cost is too much, even at University of North Carolina institutions, places like that.
So you have said, Doctor, and you kind of alluded to this in the last comment that you made, that the educations received at these schools are often inferior. When you say that, are you talking about the schools that are giving academic educations for furthering your education at a higher level, or these beauty school kinds of places? What are you referring to?
So a couple of things. So let me speak to the fact that, yes, the sector is diverse, and I actually pay a lot of attention to that in the book because I actually worked both in the beauty college sector, mm-hmm. Which is, I think, representative of sort of the short-term job training programs in the sector, and also worked in a degree-granting technical college. And I do talk about how they are serving students in similar ways, but with very different sort of experiences for the students, and why we then might want to think about these things a bit more holistically and with more nuance. Students who were attending someplace like the beauty college were often looking for, again, something that would satisfy the requirements for credentialing. And while they were paying more than what it would have cost for them to get the same credential at CPCC, what they were paying for, they could realistically maybe repay the student loan with what was expected from their cosmetology career. That is a lot less clear amongst degree-granting institutions. And in fact, we do find from field experiments where we send resumes out to employers that there is a negative bias against schools that are perceived to be for-profit colleges among hiring managers. So what I'm saying there that when we talk about whether or not these are good schools, again, it is both whether or not it's good for the individual. And I've said we've actually focused too narrowly on whether or not a student is satisfied. College is about more than customer satisfaction, mostly because students are more than customers. It is also about whether other people value it and whether or not they're getting the same benefits from having attended school that we have always associated with going to college. And in fact, at almost every level, however you want to sort of slice that, mobility, income, employment, job quality and job flexibility, students in the for-profit college sector are not getting, in the aggregate, on average, the impact from having attended college, especially when we factor in the student loan debt.
We talked a little while ago before Steve Gunderson had to leave from CECU about the gainful employment rule that Betsy DeVos is suggesting be eliminated, the Obama-era rule, which would cut off federal aid funds to career-oriented programs that produce too many graduates with debt that they cannot repay based on salaries that they can get after they get their degree. That seems to me, as an outsider, like a pretty bad deal. Not only the elimination of that seems like a pretty bad deal, not only for students, but for taxpayers. Because aren't taxpayers footing the bill for some of this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the one thing that the for-profit colleges often don't talk about is the fact that the vast majority of their revenue stream comes from either Pell Grants or federally guaranteed loans. So, you know, there's something called the 90-10 rule, which means that schools can't get more than 90% of their revenue either from those sources or oftentimes from GI Bill benefits. That's another big population in the for-profit sector, which is military veterans. So, and a lot of schools go right up to that, close to that 90% line. That's a very very common facet. Taxpayers are on the hook for a lot of money for these institutions.
So for-profit schools are in the business to make a profit for their owners and or their shareholders. Can the profit motive and the need to control costs in order to make that profit sometimes eclipse academic concerns, or is that an outdated way of thinking about this? Is that a bias that comes from those of us who went to state schools and private schools?
Yes, is there a little bit of bias about the idea that profit is inherently evil? Absolutely. Listen, I'll be honest about that. It is also, however, empirically true, meaning we can count and observe certain things. And one of the things that we can count and observe is, for example, things like how much money a for-profit college spends on student instruction as opposed to something like marketing and advertising, right? So we can sort of count the cost of what a for-profit college is investing in and what we might think of as direct educational benefits for students as opposed to things that are related to them generating more revenue. And what we find in the for-profit college sector, some of my colleagues out at University of California have done amazing work showing that for-profit colleges not only spend less on instruction than they do on marketing and advertising, of which very few not-for-profit colleges could say they equal. There are a couple. But of the money that they spend on instruction is very limited to direct classroom instruction and not, again, all of those other things that tend to go along with higher education, the counseling, the remediation, et cetera. And those are things that would be really important to the types of students in particular who end up going to for-profit colleges. Many have had negative experiences with previous education and sort of need that extra help. And so the pursuit of profit is often in direct tension with the types of resources that students in for-profit colleges need the most because they are expensive.
So we have about a minute left, and Betsy DeVos is also proposing to raise the standards for students who are misled by their schools in seeking to have their federal loans forgiven. It would make it more difficult, to a more onerous thing to have that happen.
Almost impossible.
Okay. Yeah. So, and if it's true what you say, Doctor, that the most vulnerable students are paying the high price for attending these for-profit schools, mm-hmm. what is the solution? What should they do? Where should they go?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly right now, at the federal level, the solution would be doing the exact opposite of everything the Department of Education is currently proposing. But at the student level, what should students be doing? I think those of us in communities actually need to do better by students. We do not have a conversation in things like our churches and our community groups and our public discourse about what a for-profit college is and the types of questions students should be asking. They should be asking things like not only how easy is it for me to attend your school, but how likely is it that I will graduate from it? And how likely is it that an employer will value my education here? Those types of questions are actually much more complex. They become more challenging, I think, for the people on the other side of the desk at a for-profit college to ask. And then we should also be asking, why haven't we provided better opportunities for people to get good work?
And let me stop you there because we're out of time. Dr. Tressie McMillan-Cottom, author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy, and Eric Kelderman with The Chronicle for Higher Ed. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.